Thank you for joining us for this webinar, The Next Generation of E-Verify, Getting Employer Verification Right. My name is Mark Rosenblum. I'm a senior policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute and co-author of the E-Verify report that we released earlier this month, and which you can find on our website, www.migrationpolicy.org. A couple of housekeeping matters before we get started. If you have any problems accessing this webinar or have a problem with the slideshow, please contact my colleague, Kristen Hayden, who's here with me today. Her email is khayden, that's K-H-A-Y-D-E-N, at migrationpolicy.org. You will receive a copy of today's PowerPoint presentation after today's call. This webinar is being recorded, and a recording of the webinar will be available on our website in the next few weeks. If you don't wish to be recorded, please do not ask any voice questions. You can still ask questions by chat function. So speaking of that, during the formal presentation, which is about to start, you will be able to ask questions by chat function. Simply enter your question and hit return. I'll collect these questions and I'll open the floor to chat and voice questions at the end of my presentation. The default setting on your call is muted. So if you have a voice question, you'll have to indicate that to us by pressing star one. And then we can identify you and unmute your line in order for you to ask an audible question to the entire group. And we'll do that at the end of the presentation. So I'm going to go ahead and get started. Thank you again for joining the call. I'm going to be going through a slideshow, and what I'll do in my talk is I'm going to begin with a background on E-Verify, and then I'll go through an analysis of the current system and talk about its strengths and weaknesses, and then I'll make two sets of recommendations, a set of recommendations concerning short-term reforms to the existing E-Verify program, and then a set of recommendations concerning long-term pilot programs that would lay the groundwork for the next generation of E-Verify, for an enhanced E-Verify system. And then at the end, I'll discuss sort of the legislative and regulatory landscape and where we are right now on electronic verification. Oops. Sorry, I'm learning how to use this as I go along. So before I begin, let me just acknowledge my co-author, Doris Meisner, who co-authored the E-Verify report on our website. And let me also thank several people who gave us feedback on earlier drafts of the E-Verify report, and they're thanked in the report, which is on our website. I also want to say something before we get started about the limits of electronic verification and what we can realistically hope to accomplish with E-Verify or some enhanced version of E-Verify. So let me make three points about this. Getting electronic verification right, the reforms that I'll talk about today, will be expensive. It's a set of improvements that we need to make, but it will be a major investment in our immigration enforcement system. And even in a best-case scenario, electronic verification is not a silver bullet that is going to solve all of our immigration enforcement needs. What we hope to accomplish with the reformed version of E-Verify or with sort of under a best-case scenario is that E-Verify will make it easier for good faith employers to play by the rules, but even a perfect electronic verification system will not make it harder for bad faith employers to not use it. So the point that I want to make with this introductory comment is that it's very important that new E-Verify mandates or new mandates for some other electronic verification system occur in the context of comprehensive immigration reform. And the reason is that simply requiring people to use E-Verify without fixing the broader immigration system will likely have bad adverse consequences and will likely encourage employers to opt out of the system rather than using a reformed system. So all of my comments about fixing E-Verify and about possibilities for an enhanced verification system should be understood in the context of a broader set of comprehensive immigration reforms. I also want to give you I will at the end of the talk give you links to our E-Verify report and to an article on our newsletter, The Source, which includes some additional statistics and information about E-Verify. Okay, so let me begin by giving you some of the background on E-Verify, starting with the legislative history. The background background, the legislative history of employment verification began in the U.S. in 1986 with the Immigration Reform and Control Act. This was the first legislation passed in the United States that made it illegal to employ unauthorized workers, undocumented immigrants. Following the implementation of IRCA, the 1986 IRCA, it was pretty quickly observed that employers lacked an effective tool to avoid hiring undocumented immigrants because they didn't have a system for verifying workers' authorization to work in the United States. And this finding was highlighted in a number of reports from the GAO and from independent analysts, and then was also emphasized by the U.S. Commission on Immigration Reform, the Jordan Commission, in its 1994 report. And the Jordan Commission specifically recommended developing an electronic or a call-in system for verifying workers' authorization to work in the United States. And that recommendation was the background for legislation that Congress passed in 1996 as part of the – well, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, the IRA-IRA, and included in that legislation was authorization for a pilot program to implement the Jordan Commission's recommendations. So that pilot program, which was called the Basic Pilot, was implemented beginning in 1997. There were two other pilot programs tested during the late 1990s. They were both discontinued, and the Basic Pilot was expanded to cover all 50 states in 2003 through the Basic Pilot Program Extension and Expansion Act. And I apologize that my slide is, doesn't have that on there. So that's the legislative authority under which the program that's now called E-Verify operates. Let me mention a couple of specific policy issues, again, sort of in the spirit of background. Basic Pilot, which is now E-Verify, the system for electronic verification, was designed to address two specific failures that were observed after passage of IRCA. One of these failures was that under the IRCA regime, the rules that IRCA establishes for employers to verify workers' authorization to work in the United States relies on workers presenting documents and employers reviewing those documents and attesting to their face validity. It was quickly observed. It was quickly observed after, as IRCA was implemented, that workers were able to use fraudulent documents, fake IDs, to present themselves as legal workers and to obtain employment in the United States, and that, you know, even when employers made good faith efforts to verify their worker status, they were vulnerable to document fraud, and it became it was a major barrier to preventing the employment of undocumented immigrants. It was also observed in the following IRCA's passage that in many cases, employers who were attempting to enforce document requirements discriminated against workers who were Hispanic workers or workers who appeared that they might be foreign-born or might be undocumented. So this flaw in the IRCA system was identified by GAO and other sources, and these are really the two main motivations for developing Basic Pilot and E-Verify, were to prevent document fraud and to prevent discrimination against legal immigrants and U.S. citizens who might appear or be suspected of being undocumented or of being foreign-born. In order to do that, E-Verify confronts two discrete tasks. The first task is that it must authenticate the identity of workers. So workers present themselves to employers and tell the employer who they are, and there's a burden on employers, and the system must be designed to allow employers to authenticate that workers are who they claim to be. So that's an authentication of identity. That's one task that E-Verify or that any verification system must accomplish. And then a second task is to verify the worker's authorization to work in the United States. So the first task involves linking an individual with that individual's name. The second task involves linking that name to a work authorization based on their immigration status. As we think about designing a system to accomplish those tasks, if we're sitting down to design a verification system today, in our report we talk about three sort of core goals that we think this system should aspire to. One of those goals is employer neutrality. So we don't want employers making discretionary judgments about workers. We want employers to be neutral arbiters and to respond to directions that they receive from the system. A second key goal is that the system ought to protect privacy and worker rights. And as we think about designing a system like this or making reforms to a system like this, we have to remember that the vast majority of workers who are going to be verified through this system are U.S. citizens. The same system will confirm U.S. citizens' authorization to work as it will non-citizens' authorization to work. So the system has to be sensitive to U.S. citizens' rights. And a third goal that we identify in our report is that it's very important that we have opportunities to test and evaluate this system as it's implemented. And what we've seen during the first decade plus that E-Verify has been online is that the system has evolved in unpredictable ways. And we anticipate that as we expand this system in the context of comprehensive immigration reform, possibly to include or eventually likely to include all employers, that we may see additional bumps in the road. So it'll be very important to evaluate the system as we go along and continue to make adjustments. So let me now say something about how E-Verify works. And I'm going to just be very brief in these comments and refer you to the diagram on the slideshow and also to the GAO report, which it's taken from, which is available on the GAO website, and also to our report, which goes into some detail about how E-Verify works. But in broad overview, the way E-Verify works is that when a new worker is hired by an employer, the employer fills out an I-9 form, which all employers in the United States are required to do for new hires. And in that process, they get the worker's name and Social Security number, and if it's a foreign-born worker, their A number, or if it's a non-citizen, their A number. That information that goes on the I-9 form is then submitted through a secure website to the E-Verify system by the employer. The employer types in that I-9 data. The data is checked against the Social Security database, and if the data are matched there for foreign-born workers, it is then checked against DHS databases and possibly secondarily checked by independent verifiers at the Department of Homeland Security if it's not immediately matched to a DHS database. If the data are matched against the Social Security and DHS databases, the employer is immediately notified that the worker is authorized to work in the United States. If the data can't be matched against one or both of those databases and can't be matched by an independent status verifier at DHS by an individual, then the employer is notified that the worker has been tentatively non-confirmed. In that case, the employer is required to notify the worker that they've received a tentative non-confirmation and give the worker an opportunity to contest that finding and to show that they are, in fact, authorized to work in the United States. If the worker fails to contest the finding or is unable to successfully contest the finding, then the employer is notified that the worker is not confirmed, is not authorized to work in the United States. And the worker receives what's called, or the employer receives a final non-confirmation. And in that case, the employer is encouraged to fire the worker. This is how the system works in theory. It doesn't always work that way in practice, and I'll talk about that a bit in a moment. So before getting into some of those strengths and weaknesses, let me just show you a picture of recent expansion and use of the program. So as this figure shows, following E-Verify's authorization in 1996 and the program's initiation in 1997, it did not attract a high level of employer registrations during the 1990s and the first years of this decade. And as of January 2006, there are only about 5,000 employers registered to use the program, and only about half of those employers regularly use the program. As you can see in the figure, beginning in 2007, registration in the program has really shot up in a dramatic fashion to close to 140,000 employers as of this month, July 2009. Again, not all of those 140,000 employers regularly use the program. Historically, about half of all registered employers use the program for all of their hires, but we've still seen dramatic growth in the program. These 140,000 employers represent close to 500,000 discrete locations, and about 14% now of all hires in the United States are verified through E-Verify. I've got a link there on this slide to the source article on E-Verify, which also includes a table that breaks down E-Verify registration by state and also has data on different state-level requirements to use E-Verify. So let me now say something about how E-Verify works from an analytic perspective, what works well and what doesn't work well. Before I get into those details, let me just make a couple of introductory comments. One introductory comment I want to make, I'm going to offer some statistics about, you know, ways in which some performance statistics for E-Verify. I want to, before I do that, warn you that our data about E-Verify is somewhat limited. Most of the data on E-Verify comes from independent analyses of the program contracted by DHS with the WESTAT, which is a research organization. And WESTAT doesn't systematically measure some of the statistics that we might be interested in. So some of the statistics on E-Verify performance we have to infer. And some of the statistics that we'd potentially be most interested in are very difficult to measure at all, would be very difficult to measure. And so one of the reasons WESTAT doesn't measure all of the performance statistics is that it would require extensive follow-up research on workers who have been confirmed or non-confirmed by the system. And it's something that Congress hasn't asked DHS to do and DHS hasn't asked WESTAT to do. And so we have some limitations about exactly what we know about the program. And let me also observe that as much as the recent growth in the program has been dramatic, future projected growth would be quite a bit more dramatic. So let me show you another picture that includes projected enrollment in E-Verify under this is the schedule that I put into this picture is what the SAVE Act, which has been introduced in the House, would mandate. And what I want you to notice about this picture, that dramatic growth that we've observed between 2007 and 2009 is barely perceivable at all when compared to the future growth that would be required to accommodate all U.S. employers. So the dashed line here is the schedule that SAVE projects, the SAVE Act, would require employers to begin using the system. And that point at the far right-hand side of your picture, which is in this picture says about 7 million, you could actually call it about 6 million, would be the total number of employers who would be required to use E-Verify under the SAVE Act. So as you can see, looking into the future, we would have dramatic growth in use of the program, and that entails some uncertainty about all of the statistics I'm going to quote to you. We should take with a grain of salt because the fact is that we won't really know how the system will perform following all this growth until this growth happens. So given the projection for so many additional enrollments, there's just a fair amount of uncertainty about what E-Verify will look like in the future. Okay, so let me now talk about what E-Verify does well and what doesn't do well. The main thing that E-Verify does well is that E-Verify prevents the most common types of document fraud. So I mentioned that currently it's relatively easy for unauthorized immigrants to obtain a fake ID and to present it to the employer and to demonstrate to the employer that the immigrant is authorized to work in the United States. And it's difficult for good faith employers to distinguish between legal immigrants and undocumented immigrants in many cases. E-Verify will detect the most common types of fake IDs because when E-Verify submits the information on those IDs to the DHS and Social Security websites, the information on the fake IDs is not in the database, and those workers can be identified as unauthorized to work. So this is a major improvement in our ability to an employer's ability to detect unauthorized immigrants and fills a major gap in our immigration control system. However, the program continues to confront some important limitations. And I'm going to take these slides in a slightly different order than you see them, and begin by talking about identity fraud. So while E-Verify is good at detecting the most common types of fake IDs, it cannot reliably detect identity fraud. It cannot reliably tell the employer whether the person in front of them is actually the person whose name is on the ID. So E-Verify can detect fake IDs that don't have that are not based on the identity data of U.S. citizens or legal immigrants, but E-Verify can't tell if a person presents a borrowed or stolen ID or presents a fake ID that uses genuine U.S. citizen identity data. So this is a limit on its ability to prevent undocumented employment or to detect undocumented immigrants presenting themselves for work in the United States. This is probably this is a major vulnerability in E-Verify, and the exact scope of the problem within E-Verify is not known. But we can say something about identity fraud in general, and in general, identity fraud is a serious problem in the United States. The FTC received 318,000 identity theft complaints last year. The Javelin Research and Strategy Group estimates that there are almost 10 million total cases of identity theft in the United States in 2008. We don't know exactly how many of these have come, directly through E-Verify. USCIS has been working to address this problem. USCIS has been working to address this problem through two main tools. One tool is a photo screening tool. And what the photo screening tool does is for certain workers who present certain types of identity documents, E-Verify returns a picture of the photograph from the worker's identity card that is registered with the DHS database. This is a powerful tool potentially to prevent identity theft, except that it's limited to about 5 to 7% of all workers using the system. A second tool that USCIS is exploring to prevent identity theft is called data blocking. And what this would do would be to allow citizens and other legal workers to turn off their identity data except for when they are using it to prevent other people from using their identity data. This is a tool that USCIS has explored but not yet implemented. I want to emphasize that as we think about expanding E-Verify to all U.S. employers, and if you have in your mind the picture I showed you a minute ago of how much growth that would entail, that identity fraud represents a very serious threat to E-Verify expansion. And when we think about requiring all employers to verify their workforce through identity through E-Verify, it would create a major new market for stolen identity data, so a new market for identity fraud, and it would also create new mechanisms for identity thieves to access and to obtain access to stolen identity data, either by posing as employers or because corrupt employees at firms using E-Verify would get access to workers' data. So these are major concerns that USCIS is working on and that policymakers need to pay attention to as we think about expanding E-Verify or creating another mandatory system. So a second limitation of E-Verify is that the system makes mistakes in non-confirming some U.S. citizens and legal immigrants. And basically the reason this problem occurs is that there are errors in the DHS and Social Security databases. Those databases must be constantly updated as people's names and statuses change. Users also make mistakes in entering data. All of these things can cause U.S. citizens or other legal workers to be wrongly non-confirmed by the system. We know this happens at least 0.3% of the time. We think that this could happen about a total of 1% of the time, which would equate to 600,000 workers a year being wrongly non-confirmed in a universal system. it's quite possible that that error rate would increase as we mandate that new employers use the system and scale up use of the system. And I'm not going to go into details of why that would be, but we can talk about that in the Q&A. USCIS has done a lot to address this problem. They've reduced the error rate by about 90% in the last 5 years by doing a better job of making the databases talk to each other and by correcting errors. But in our report, we argue that most of the errors that DHS can correct have been corrected, and that that roughly 1% error rate is probably here to stay. So a third problem with E-Verify is that the system often fails to give an immediate sort of red light, green light response. And the reason for this relates to the problem I just mentioned, which is that the system has to give workers an opportunity to correct mistakes when they occur. And currently, the system relies on employers to give workers the information they need to correct those mistakes. On average, it takes over a month when those when tentative non-confirmations are issued to finalize that finding from start to finish, from the point of hire to a final result in the system can take on average 40 days. USCIS has been working to speed this process, mostly by limiting limiting errors in the first place. But given that workers need to have an opportunity to correct errors in the database, this is sort of a structural limit of the existing program. And again, this is a problem that could easily increase as the program increases in size. It's already a major irritant for people, for employers who use the program, and it could become a much larger problem in a universal system. So a fourth sort of problem with the current system that is related to the previous one is that employers often misuse the system and may even abuse the system. And the point here is that employers are really looking for a quick verification that a worker is authorized to work or not authorized to work. And when an employer gets a tentative non-confirmation, they have incentives to their economic interests are in pushing to resolve that quickly rather than in ensuring that the worker takes advantage of every opportunity to correct an erroneous finding. So some employers fail to inform workers of a tentative non-confirmation or discourage workers from contesting a tentative non-confirmation and simply move on to a different worker. The point that we make in the report is not that employers are bad guys in using the system, but that the system imposes an unreasonable burden on employers in asking them to manage the uncertainty that's built into the system. So again, this could also become a much more significant problem in a universal system. And we cite some statistics in the report that employer non-compliance with the worker protections built into the system is already pretty widespread. So quickly, there is uncertainty inevitably built into any verification system. There's uncertainty about authenticating workers' identity, and there's uncertainty about verifying their authorization to work. USCIS has done a good job of reducing that uncertainty where it's possible to do so, but the current E-Verify system relies on employers. We call it an employer-centric design to manage that remaining uncertainty, and relying on employers exacerbates those problems and is costly to employers and costly to workers. So our recommendations are in the spirit of both reducing that uncertainty, but also in the spirit of mitigating the effects of the employer-centric design and eventually moving away from an employer-centric design to a system that's more employer-neutral. So in the short run, we recommend three sets of changes to E-Verify that can be implemented immediately that would mitigate the effects of employer management of the system and would also reduce errors. Just to go through those recommendations briefly, we recommend changes to limit erroneous non-confirmations, to make sure that the system does not non-confirm U.S. citizens and other legal workers. And the key recommendations there are that the system needs to have a mechanism for workers to check and correct their own records, and it must have an appeal mechanism and a system to redress errors when the system wrongly non-confirms U.S. citizens. And we go into greater detail in the report, so you can look to the report, or we can discuss this in the Q&A. A second set of recommendations is that E-Verify must do more to prevent employer misuse of the system. And some of that work involves better education of better education targeting employers so they understand how they're required to use the system, better education of workers so they understand their rights in the system, better oversight to make sure that employers are following the rules. And the most important change here is that there must be penalties imposed on employers who misuse and abuse the system, misuse or abuse the system. And those penalties should be part of the Immigration and Nationality Act, along with existing law against discrimination against discrimination on the basis of nationality. And Section 274B of the INA is a framework that can handle that. And then a third set of recommendations we make for the current E-Verify system is to strengthen auditing and oversight of enforcement for the purpose of immigration control. So that includes more sophisticated auditing for misuse and especially for non-use of the system to make sure that employers are actually verifying all of their workers. Congress should create an Office of Database Accuracy that would do more detailed analysis of the error rates that I referred to and would do the follow-up research that would allow us to have a better grasp on exactly how well the system is working. It's very important that the various enforcement agencies concerned with worksite enforcement and immigration enforcement coordinate their enforcement efforts. And then we also recommend that that DHS have access to some IRS and Social Security data that it can use to look for likely cases of identity fraud and likely cases of employer non-use of the system. This would be a very powerful enforcement tool. It raises a lot of privacy concerns, and we talk in the report briefly about how to constrain DHS access to that data to make sure that it respects privacy and to make sure that data is shared responsibly. So in the long run, we recommend an additional set of reforms that would begin to move away from the employer-centric model that we see in E-Verify and would establish a better system, sort of a better infrastructure for managing employment verification. All of these long-run reforms that we think about or that we discuss in the report would require an enrollment process. And that enrollment process would be quite burdensome. And I'm looking to see if I have a slide on it. Yes. So what the enrollment process would entail would be that eventually all U.S. citizens and all other legal workers in the United States would be required to visit a USCIS field office or a post office or some government agency to enroll in an enhanced E-Verify database. So that enrollment process would represent a significant financial burden and a significant burden on U.S. citizens. It would also be technically complex because there are about 22 million U.S. citizens who lack official government identity documents, and those citizens would have a hard time proving their identity and doing the enrollment process. And the enrollment process must, on one hand, accommodate those citizens while also screening out any unauthorized immigrants who might fraudulently claim U.S. Citizenship or claim legal status. So striking that balance is going to be a technical challenge, but that's a challenge that we confront with any verification system. The enrollment process simply brings that to the forefront. Once we consider an enrollment process like that, it opens up several options for a better infrastructure for managing employment verification. So one option that we can think about is a card-based system. And the way a card-based system would work is that you know, through this enrollment process, we would issue more secure cards that indicate that card bearers are authorized to work in the United States. In principle, a card-based system has a lot of advantages, and in short, a card-based system with a secure card that indicates work authorization is really sort of the most elegant way to handle employment verification. So in fact, if we had a sort of a perfect work authorization card, we don't really need E-Verify because any worker who has the card is authorized to work. The card represents the verification system. So this makes it a very attractive solution to eligibility verification. And more generally, Americans expect cards to perform a role like that. So one of the attractions of a card-based system is that we have a lot of expectations that, you know, some kind of a government-issued identity card can be sort of a central feature in a verification system. There are some limits to what a card-based system can accomplish, though. And the most important limit is that as much as we can talk about secure cards, in fact, there really is no such thing as a fraud-proof card. And as soon as we develop new card technology and invest a lot of importance in a new card, fraudulent cards will emerge, and we should be skeptical of a card-based solution. As much as Americans expect cards to be part of the solution, they're also suspicious of identity cards, as Real ID has shown us, and we would also be concerned that any card-based solution would creep in to other aspects besides employment verification. Cards also require employers to make judgments about workers' identity. So a second strategy for sort of a next generation of E-Verify is what we call a PIN pre-verification system. And the way this system would work is that following enrollment, workers would be required to check in with the system to activate their number. During the enrollment process, a worker's identity data would be locked. And following enrollment, verification would occur in two stages. In the first stage, workers would check in with the system using a PIN number to activate their number. And in doing that, they would receive a verification code that indicates that they work authorized. And they would give that code to employers in the second stage. And employers would simply enter the code and get a red light, green light response. And the advantage to this PIN system is that it would prevent identity theft because workers would have to check in with the system using their PIN number and would be notified if somebody else was checking in with the system with their PIN number. And the other important advantage, I'm going to skip over some of this, is that it would front load all of the tentative non-confirmation process and allow workers to correct their own record without relying on employers. So it would allow employers then to get a simple red light, green light response rather than going through the tentative non-confirmation process. The weakness of this system is that it would be vulnerable to identity sharing. If a worker gives somebody else their PIN number, somebody else would be able to check in with the system. And so this system would rely on photo screening or some other authentication tool to make sure that workers aren't sharing PIN numbers. And then a final sort of next generation system that we discuss in the report is biometric scanning. And what biometric scanning refers to is a system in which, in addition to say, looking at an identity card, or instead of looking at an identity card, employers would capture biometric data from their new employees, for example, by scanning their fingerprints or their irises. The advantage of this system is that this is the most reliable system for preventing both identity theft and identity sharing. You can't really share your fingerprint with somebody. And so it would shift responsibility for identity authentication away from employers and onto the government through this biometric scanning. The disadvantages are that this entails a substantial increase in costs for employers who have to obtain biometric scanning devices, and also the social cost of requiring workers to give their fingerprints when they take new jobs. We would be concerned that you would struggle to get high levels of compliance, that many Americans would object to giving their fingerprints in order to get a job. There are also technological limits to this system. We would still confront false non-confirmations because the technology behind biometrics remains imperfect, and with fingerprints in particular. Let me just briefly, because we're running out of time and I want to leave time for questions, say something about the legislative landscape. As most of you know, the Department of Homeland Security recently announced that it would begin implementing changes to the Federal Acquisitions Regulations Act, the FAR regulations, which will require federal contractors to use the E-Verify system beginning in September. So that implements a change announced by the Bush administration that had previously been delayed by the Obama administration. E-Verify has recently been, or E-Verify funding will run out at the end of this fiscal year. The House and Senate have both reauthorized, have both passed bills to reauthorize E-Verify funding as part of the DHS appropriations bills, but they've passed different authorizing language. So whether and how Congress will reauthorize E-Verify funding will be determined in a conference committee. And the Senate authorization bill imposed some new E-Verify mandates and some other sort of pro-enforcement amendments that are not in the House bill that will be worked out in conference committee. There are also two House bills that have been offered, which or have been filed, which touch on E-Verify. The new Employee Verification Act, sponsored by Sam Johnson, would mandate that employers on a timeline to be determined by DHS use E-Verify and would also establish a separate pilot program that uses biometrics, and it would shift responsibility from DHS to Social Security Administration for managing E-Verify. And then the SAVE Act, sponsored by Heath Shuler, would also mandate use of E-Verify. The new Employee Verification Act also addresses some of the worker protections and due process protections that we outline in our E-Verify report. Senator Schumer has also been giving a lot of attention to E-Verify and laid out some principles in a recent Senate hearing. And Senator Schumer has identified mandatory electronic verification as one of his seven principles for comprehensive immigration reform. So we can anticipate that any comprehensive bill that comes out of either chamber would almost certainly include provisions for mandatory electronic verification. So just by way of conclusion, and then I will open it up for questions, let me again emphasize that any electronic verification system will rely on the good faith compliance of its employers. So the system has to be user-friendly or employers will simply not use it. And the burden of any enrollment system, any system for new biometrics or any other sort of new identity card will fall overwhelmingly on U.S. citizens who will be required to register in a new system, enroll in a new system. And the burden of any new enforcement requirements will fall on businesses. So it's vital that new verification requirements both be user-friendly and occur in the context of broader comprehensive immigration reform that will encourage immigrants and employers to opt into the system rather than creating incentives for people to go around the system. When we think about the scope of expansion that we've already seen in the last couple of years and the additional dramatic growth that would be anticipated in moving to a universal system, we should anticipate that we will see unintended consequences, as we've already seen with E-Verify. And so we strongly recommended our report that Congress authorize DHS to test multiple systems to mandate E-Verify on a basic level, but to test multiple pilot programs for these enhanced versions of E-Verify and to evaluate as we go along how those work and which ones should receive additional mandates. So I'll stop there, and I'll open it up for questions. If you've got text questions, you can send them with your chat box. And if you'd like to ask a question out loud, we'd ask you to press *1 so we can identify you and unmute your line. So if you're stunned into silence, I'm happy to, just choose some things to go into more detail on. but I'm going to give a moment for people to come up with some questions.
It looks like we have one voice. So we're going to let you ask.
I think one of you requested to ask a voice question. But you seem to have changed your mind. Okay, well, I'd be happy to, unless folks have other questions, I would be happy to go through a bit more detail on how the three different pilot programs that we've described in our report would work, and in particular, how they could be phased in alongside new E-Verify mandates.
It looks like our question or.
Okay, I'm going to let you ask your voice question first. Go ahead, please.
This is from Erin.
Hi, this is Erin Kelly with Gannett Washington Papers. I have a question for you about biometrics. And could you talk a little bit about companies that might already be using this type of a system? Maybe not for employment verification, but for other purposes?
Sure. I'll say a couple things more about biometrics. As Erin just observed, many companies collect biometric data from their employees either for the purpose of doing security background checks or to issue identity cards, for internal record keeping. When we talk about a biometric system, there's really sort of two pieces of that that mirror any of the enhanced systems that I described. One is that there is a biometric collection period. So those companies that collect biometric data from their workers must, initiate that process by, when they hire those workers or enroll them in the system, they get their fingerprints the first time. And then the way biometric scanning works is that when the employee later, wants to access the secure area, or, if they're being done checked against a background check, the data that is collected, data is collected a second time and compared against that database. So, I mean, there's a couple of different contexts in which this occurs now. One is, like I said, to, get access to a secure area, for example. Once an employee registers their biometric with the company, they then, would use a fingerprint scan to, get additional access. And in that case, their subsequent fingerprint scan is compared to the data that was initially collected. A second thing that biometrics are already used for is background checks, security checks, and including checks done by the FBI. In this case, fingerprints that are collected from new employees or also from people who are booked through the criminal justice system are compared against the FBI's database of existing fingerprints and checked in that case against the full set of FBI prints that so that they can be matched up against known criminals or suspected terrorists or other identities of interest. I want to emphasize that the verification task that a biometric E-Verify system would be required to handle is a little bit different because it would more closely resemble the first situation I described where businesses are using data that they've collected to then let a worker come in again later. What E-Verify would have to do, or what an enhanced E-Verify would have to do, is to do a one-to-one match. It would have to compare a worker's biometric against a registered record, either in a database or on a card, rather than against the entire database to look for an unknown match. So when you check data against the FBI database, you're comparing a set of fingerprints against all 60 million records in the FBI database. What an enhanced E-Verify would have to do would be to compare a record against a single record, either in its database or on a card, to confirm that a worker is who they claim to be. So I'm not sure if that is the specific question you looked at. I've also got a few chat questions. So, she's still unmuted. So, Erin, if you have a follow-up question, and then I'm going to pick some chat. I'm going to answer some chat questions here.
What kind of companies specifically are using biometrics right now?
You know, I'm not – I wouldn't want to describe myself as an expert on sort of the private business use of biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
I know that that many companies do that, you know, for many companies contract out to do background checks on their employees, you know, because they're handling sensitive data, you know, and or for their identity cards. But if you want to, I mean, that's something that I can also, if you want to send me an email later, I can tell you a little bit more about that offline.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so let me now, I'm going to answer a couple of questions that we've gotten from the chats. One question is, what advice can we give employers now under the current system to help them keep their workers but also stay on DHS's good side? You know, that's a great question, and it's really a question for an immigration attorney, not for me, but the policy implication of that question I think is tremendously important, which is that what businesses really want is a system that will not just keep them on DHS's good side, but actually give them reliable information about their workers' identity and more importantly, about their workers' authorization to work in the United States. And this question gets to one of the key criticisms of E-Verify is that even when firms use E-Verify, they may unknowingly hire undocumented immigrants. And there have been a couple of high-profile cases where firms have used E-Verify and then been found to have many undocumented immigrants on their payrolls, and businesses have been frustrated by E-Verify's inability to, you know, give them reliable answers, and also by the fact that E-Verify does not give them immunity from immigration prosecution under 274A, and you know, so the questioner asked what employers can do now. The answer is that we really need to fix E-Verify and to make it a system that gives them reliable information. And in doing that, you know, Congress will likely consider offering employers immunity from immigration prosecution as long as they have, you know, carefully complied with all of the system's requirements. But that's not how the current law is structured. And, you know, part of the reason that law is not structured that way is that the system doesn't work well enough to give reliable answers. And so, you know, Congress and DHS haven't felt that the system works well enough to offer employers immunity. A second question that came in by chat is, how do I see the Real ID or proposed Pass ID acts affecting E-Verify? That's another good question. One of the things that USCIS is really interested in is doing is to do a lot more photo screening, and what I mean by that is to be able to send employers electronically, or possibly by you know, an attachment to a cell phone, a picture of the worker from the worker's identity card. Right now, they only have that capacity for recently issued green cards and employment authorization documents with visas. The Pass ID or Real ID, in theory, create opportunities to expand photo screening to state DMVs, to driver's licenses, which is the document that the vast majority of U.S. citizens use to authenticate, you know, their identity in this verification process. So passage of Pass ID and more importantly, implementation of Pass ID or implementation of Real ID, but Pass ID at this point actually looks probably more promising. Either one of those, you know, universally implemented would create the potential to do photo screening with driver's license data. That's not part of Pass ID right now. It's something that would have to be negotiated on a state-by-state level. USCIS has been looking for states that would allow them to get access to DMV data, or something that Congress could look into mandating. But as of now, Pass ID sort of would create an infrastructure that would make that feasible, but it's not, you know, part of the legislation. And then a third question that we received by chat, I indicated earlier that USCIS probably will be unable to further reduce the false non-confirmation rate. Why is that? That's a great question. And let me say that USCIS doesn't necessarily agree with me on that point. They, you know, have some plans in place. They've made really quite good progress on reducing the erroneous non-confirmation rate in the last 5 years, probably by about 90%. We argue in our report, and I believe, that there is sort of a baseline error rate that comes from root errors in the database. I mean, both the DHS and Social Security databases have some mistakes because they are human-created databases. And until those mistakes are detected, the only way that those mistakes get detected is by people trying to verify themselves through E-Verify or trying to get Social Security benefits, for example, and being non-confirmed or you know, finding an error when they actually go into the system. So it's very difficult to think about going through and cleaning those databases other than by using a system like E-Verify. So some of those errors are only going to be detected that way. Another reason that we anticipate that it'll be difficult to get further reductions in errors is that both of those databases are dynamic. So people change their names and their immigration statuses because they get married, because they adjust from, you know, a temporary visa to a permanent visa, from a permanent visa to U.S. citizenship. And every time some change like that happens, the database needs to be updated, and we don't currently have a system for updating either those databases in real time, essentially. So those mistakes are going to be persistent. And then the third sort of persistent source of error is that there's always going to be some degree of user error. So we see that 1% error rate that we observe now is probably about as good as it's going to get. You know, we may see that pushed down to, you know, a 0.7% error rate or a 0.5% error rate, which would be, you know, substantial additional improvement. That would still, you know, if we had a 0.5% error rate, say, that would represent 300,000 false non-confirmations a year in a universal system. So it's still something that, you know, we would have to have strong mechanisms in place to correct for. So let me ask one final, let me answer one final question, and then I think we'll be sort of at the end of our time. Another questioner asked if we can explain data blocking once more. So the way data blocking works is that, and this is something that USCIS has explored but not yet implemented, but it's also sort of at the heart of the sort of PIN system that we describe in our report. The idea here is that workers would have the opportunity or by default would turn off their identity data so that even though, you know, even though I'm a U.S. citizen, if I were to try to be verified by E-Verify, it would show up as a non-confirmation unless I actively go in and turn on my data or you know, tell the system that I'm in fact applying for a job, so I would have I would use some tool to authenticate myself with USCIS and turn on my record, and only after that would my record be confirmed if an employer tries to verify me. So the point of data blocking is that it would prevent identity fraud, because if someone has not gone in and turned on the record, then they would get non-confirmed by the system. So the challenge with data blocking is to create a system to allow me to go in and turn on my record. The advantage of data blocking is that it would, you know, prevent identity fraud by turning off my record or by deactivating my Social Security number, except for when I'm ready to use it. So we see this as a powerful tool for protecting Americans' privacy and preventing identity theft, and also for preventing unauthorized workers from gaming the system by using a stolen identity number. All right, let me just – I'm going to quickly answer one last question, then I'm going to sign off just because I think it's an important question. Why is my estimate of the erroneous non-confirmation rate higher than USCIS's estimate? What USCIS is reporting, and I'm not sure from the questioner what they're quoting my estimate to be, but I've estimated it at about 1%. USCIS is reporting that 0.35% that is on USCIS's website, that's the sort of minimum possible number of false non-confirmations. And what that number is it's the number of people who correct a false non-confirmation. And we know that there's a large number of workers who receive a non-confirmation from the system but aren't notified of that by their employer or aren't given the adequate information by their employer to correct that record. So USCIS knows that about 0.35% of people correct non-confirmations, and they know that another 3% or so are non-confirmed and don't follow up. And what we don't know is how many of that 3% are actually undocumented immigrants and how many of them are U.S. citizens or legal immigrants who fail to correct the non-confirmation. And we know that some of them fall into that latter category, but this is one of the important sort of missing data points about E-Verify. And if you go and look at the report on our website, there's a you know, fairly extensive discussion of how we come up with our estimate of that error rate. And, you know, USCIS recognizes they no longer describe that 0.3% as a hard figure on the erroneous non-confirmations because they know that, some of the final non-confirmations are erroneous and that nobody really knows exactly how many of them fall into that category. The Westat Corporation is planning to come out with a model-based estimate of those erroneous final non-confirmations, but they haven't released it yet. So with that, I'm going to thank you for calling in. I want to, if you have any questions, feel free to email me at the email address that you see on your screen. And we will also email you a PowerPoint, and there will be an audio of this call posted in a few days. So that concludes our webinar. Thanks very much.